you're at the back of the room and you're having trouble hearing, just move closer. My name is Karen Rooney. I'm one of the organizers for the event tonight. And I really want to thank you all for coming out. We have a really good turnout, and it's nice to see really good diversity of ages in the room, so that's really good. So a few months ago, I guess in the spring of this year, there was an article that came out that started to make the connections between the nuclear industry in Saskatchewan and the expansion of the tar sands in Alberta. And I read this article, and I thought, like, oh, this is a great article. More people should read it. And I really realized that a lot of people were reading it, because some of my friends from the Maritime province were sending me the link to this article, asking me if I'd seen it. So it was starting to create a bit of debate around the issue, and just the fact that it was gaining so much reach in the country made me think that this is an issue that people really do want to talk about. And so Megan is the other co-organizer for the evening, and the two of us had some conversations over the last month and a bit around how we could start to have this discussion in a way that was relevant to people in Saskatchewan, because often when we talk about tar sands, it seems to be a very Alberta-specific debate, even though the effects affect everybody in Canada. Well, and the world, obviously. So that's how the discussion tonight came about. And I just want to remind everybody, hopefully everybody knows this already, but regardless of what your views are, our panelists here are all volunteers and have graciously agreed to come speak on their own time and, you know, are not getting anything in return. So just that we keep it respectful tonight in any questions that get asked and that kind of thing. And so I will introduce you to our panel for the evening. At the far end in the white shirt is Darcy Handy from Saskatoon, who is the author of that article I was talking about called Follow the Yellow Cake Road, which was published in Briar Patch magazine earlier this spring. And subsequently, with Mark Bigland Pritchard right here in the front, he has written another article around the greening of the tar sands with nuclear energy in Saskatchewan. And so again, like I said, this debate or these articles sparked a lot of discussion around the greening of the tar sands and alerted many people across the country to the situation happening in Saskatchewan. Darcy is one of the founding members of the Hughes 3 campaign, and that stands for Health, Uranium, Environment, Sustainability, Survival, and Solidarity. It's a volunteer-run group with a shared vision for Saskatchewan where our natural resources will be utilized for the benefit of all society and where we can build an economy that will be sustainable for all the generations to come. Next at the table is Eileen Baer, who's also from Saskatoon. And Eileen's a member of the Committee for Future Generations, which is a group that was originally formed by citizens in northern Saskatchewan who are concerned about secrecy in current proposals to make northern Saskatchewan a nuclear waste storage site. They have been active in speaking out against the targeting of three northern communities as nuclear waste burial sites and were the organizers of the 2011 7,000 Generation Walk from Pine House to Regina to raise awareness about the issue. And actually, as we speak right now, the community of Pine House is in the midst of a municipal election happening tomorrow. And there have been reports coming out of that community about intimidation and threats being made to people who are voting against you know, councillors and politicians who support these proposals. So it's very concerning what's going on in northern Saskatchewan, and we're very glad that Eileen can be here to speak on behalf of the Committee for Future Generations. Next at the table, looking very serious at his laptop, is Cam Fenton, who is from Edmonton, and he's the director of the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition. Cam has been active in climate justice organizing for years, from the Wings of Change program, which educates youth about climate change and climate justice, to being one of the main organizers behind PowerShift 2012, which is a four-day gathering happening in October of this year in Ottawa with the goal of building a stronger youth climate movement. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that tonight. And finally, Megan Van Buskirk, also from Saskatoon, is a three-time delegate to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, both as a delegate of the Worldwide Association of Girl Guides, and this year as a member of the Canadian Youth Delegation. Megan has actively worked at bringing environmental advocacy and awareness to the non-formal education program within Girl Guides, which engages the next generation in understanding the importance of sustainability. And she's currently working with the Saskatchewan Environmental Society. And finally, I'll just point out that, like I said, Dr. Mark Biglin-Pritchard is here at the front, and he's graciously agreed to answer any questions that are more speaking to the technical side of the nuclear industry and any kind of energy concerns that you may have after the speakers are done. So he is also an unofficial speaker. And so I will turn it over to Darcy, who's going to speak first. But just so you know, if you do have questions, please write them down or try to save them in your mind until after all the speakers have had their chance to share their perspective, and then we'll have a question and answer period following that. So, go ahead, Darcy.
Thanks, Karen. Good evening, everyone. And my thanks to the panel organizers for providing this opportunity for discussion and debate of the issues. Let us start out by acknowledging that in Canada today, particularly in Western Canada, the oil sands, or as most of us would rather call them, the tar sands, are the darling of the business establishment. In fact, the Alberta economy, and to a lesser degree the Saskatchewan economy, are premised on continuing expansion of tar sands development. One can only imagine the billions of dollars invested by oil companies, pipeline companies, and many tiers of support industries built around the tar sands economy. In addition to that, there are heavy subsidies of tar sands development by the federal and provincial governments. Now we are seeing heightened interest in tar sands development from large foreign investors. On the flip side, the nuclear industry is in trouble. Despite brave talk of the so-called nuclear renaissance, countries with huge economies, like Germany and Japan, are backing away from nuclear energy, particularly after the Fukushima disaster last year. The Canadian nuclear industry and Canadian governments, the feds, and most notably the Saskatchewan government, are aggressively promoting nuclear in emerging economies. Newly negotiated trade agreements with India and China have been consciously watered down the former requirements for close monitoring to ensure the safe and peaceful use of uranium and nuclear technology in those countries if they purchase Canadian product. Right now, tar sands investors have no reason to entertain the notion of nuclear reactors as a power source. Natural gas has been the fuel of choice for bitumen extraction, and natural gas is currently plentiful and cheap, so nuclear energy cannot compete economically. But that does not mean that the uranium and nuclear industry have not been actively promoting the development and deployment of nuclear reactors in the tar sands. They are looking at 10 or 20 years down the road when natural gas will no longer be a viable option. Every year, more papers are published, more panel discussions are held at nuclear conferences, and more representations are made to the tar sands industry and government, promoting the expansion of nuclear technology in the tar sands. The operative public relations hook being used by the nuclear industry is the clever term green bitumen. The argument goes that nuclear energy will drastically reduce our carbon footprint and thus alleviate the horrid reputation for carbon emissions suffered by the tar sands industry. We all know that Canada, Alberta, and Saskatchewan have failed miserably in their efforts to achieve reduction of CO2 emission targets, even as federal and provincial governments jockey to lower the bar on expectations. So, in fact, federal and provincial governments have been eager adherents to the green bitumen myth, They desperately need to demonstrate that they are somehow addressing global warming, and the hype from the nuclear industry feeds into their propaganda. Never mind that uranium mining, nuclear reactors, and storage of radioactive waste create even more environmental problems for generations to come. As I said, the nuclear industry is desperate, and in Saskatchewan, the provincial government is obsessed with economic expansionism, primarily in the form of resource extraction. They and the uranium mining industry have big dollar signs in their eyes as they push for value-added industry to complement the well-established uranium mining activity already here. The most recent manifestation of attempts to establish nuclear reactors in Alberta and Saskatchewan began in about 2006. The Alberta Energy Research Institute, the energy technology arm of the provincial government, began working with industry to design a request for proposals to build a nuclear reactor in the Fort McMurray region. Seeing a golden opportunity for expansion, this was quickly followed by private representations to the provincial government. By 2008, the Alberta Nuclear Power Expert Panel, comprising representatives from the oil and nuclear industries, began to study those proposals. The provincial government also entered into discussions with the Idaho National Laboratory, a major U.S. Department of Energy nuclear research facility, and reached agreement on ways to use nuclear energy in Alberta's oil and gas industry. When the ordinary Alberta citizens discovered what was going on, there was a grassroots uprising. A huge popular resistance ensued. Bruce Power, which operates large nuclear reactors in Ontario, soon stepped in to manage efforts to build a reactor in Alberta. But ultimately, the politicians and Bruce Power backed down. There was just too much public opposition to the proposals being offered by industry and government. By the end of 2011, the effort was entirely dead, and Bruce Power withdrew its application. If the story of what happened in Alberta sounds vaguely familiar, you will recognize many parallels with what occurred in Saskatchewan following the election of the Saskatchewan Party government in 2007. Even before the 2007 election, Brad Wall had decided to embrace a nuclear future. In a new story that May, Wall claimed, quote, "Small reactor technology is coming on fast and may present an opportunity for our province to develop our oil sands in an environmentally responsible way as the new technology produces much-needed steam as well as energy," unquote. This announcement presages quite accurately the agenda that the Wall government has religiously pursued ever since. Bruce Power and Atomic Energy of Canada Limited showed up at Saskatchewan's door soon after that election. Bruce Power made a pitch to SaskPower in 2008 extolling the benefits of a large scale nuclear reactor in Saskatchewan with the potential to export electricity to the Alberta tar sands and beyond. The Uranium Development Partnership, UDP, a Saskatchewan review panel comprising university and industry representatives, was appointed in 2008 and was keen on moving the nuclear agenda forward. The UDP chair was in fact Dr. Richard Florizone, one of the University of Saskatchewan's vice presidents, and a physicist who has long had the dream of commissioning a larger nuclear research reactor on campus. The UDP report was released in April 2009, followed by a public consultation process over the summer months. As in Alberta, the public reaction to the nuclear proposals was swift and strongly negative. Just as had happened in Alberta, the Saskatchewan government had, however, already signed an agreement with the Idaho National Laboratory in March 2009 to provide a mechanism for the government and INL to consider research and demonstration projects on a variety of energy sources and resources, including uranium, nuclear energy, heavy oil, oil shale, and oil sands. Obviously, the provincial government and the uranium industry were supremely confident that the UDP agenda would carry the day. Cameco, the biggest uranium mining corporation in the world, brought former university president Peter McKinnon to their northern Saskatchewan operations and their exclusive Yellowega fishing lodge in August of 2009, hoping to impress him with the future of nuclear in the province. He probably needed little convincing. According to the university's response to a Freedom of Information request, no report about the purpose of or the discussions involved in that visit can be found in the university records. But it was a nice excursion all the same, totally paid out of Chemical Corporation's entertainment fund. And I might add, in apparent contravention of the university's own conflict of interest guidelines. The Saskatchewan government ultimately had to retreat from the Bruce Power proposal, but then they took a different strategy from Alberta. They pursued much of their nuclear agenda by funneling funds towards research and development at the University of Saskatchewan. Largely outside public purview and in close collaboration with the university administration, the Canadian Centre for Nuclear Innovation, CCNI, was established in 2011 with $30 million of government seed money. In the CCNI business framework, the government insisted that CCNI must meet expectations for nuclear industry enhancement over the next 7 years. One of the first funding partnerships it signed was with Hitachi Business Group, including a memorandum of understanding to conduct research into the design and feasibility of small reactor technologies. A further $10 million for CCNI came along with this initiative. Small nuclear reactors are now the primary focus of research and development among the industry, the government, and the university. This technology, they say, has the potential to supply power on-site at huge industrial mining complexes like the tar sands or in potash mines. There was even talk of small nuclear reactors being used to provide electricity to remote communities. Just how public health and safety is impacted by the direct desired proliferation of nuclear reactors in ecologically sensitive milieu is a question that nobody seems to be interested in addressing at this point, but we ought to be concerned. Fully 88% of the 2,263 responses to the parents' consultation process rejected the overall strategy of the Uranium Development Partnerships report in 2009. So we all have to ask the bold question, after such a clearly negative response, what the hell happened? We thought the provincial government had heard us loud and clear. That was just 3 years ago. How is it possible that the nuclear agenda has sped along so readily and with so little public input? We have to remember that the uranium industry, and particularly Chemical Corporation, has spent many years currying favor at the University of Saskatchewan. Millions of dollars in scholarships, endowments, and capital projects at the university bear the Cameco name and attest to its corporate largesse. Many of those individuals on campus who signed letters of support for establishment of the Canadian Centre for Nuclear Innovation had witnessed Cameco donations to their departments. The most obvious example is the letter written by the director of the International Centre for Northern Governance and Development, ICNGD, at U of S. Its fervent endorsement includes a report of ICNGD's close working ties with communities, government stakeholders, and industry in northern Saskatchewan, and it singles out Cameco as one with a particularly strong relationship to ICNGD. Within days of that letter of support for CCNI being written, a press release was issued publicizing a $2 million grant to ICNGD, $1 million each, from Cameco and the provincial government. We also have to pay close attention to the corporate connections and influence here at the university. Many eyebrows have been raised by the fact that Nancy Hopkins, the chair of the Board of Governors, is also a shareholder and director of Cameco Corporation. The Board of Governors keeps its proceedings quite secret, posting only a digest of its meeting minutes online. Despite suggestions that they do so, no record of recusals is included in that digest of minutes. So the questions arise. Has Ms. Hopkins declared a conflict of interest when the board votes on issues relating to the Canadian Centre for Nuclear Innovation? And has she in fact recused herself from those discussions and votes? Several of those appointed to the CCNI board in 2011 have close connections to the nuclear industry. Did Ms. Hopkins recuse herself from the discussion and votes making those appointments? Despite claims that the CCNI is facilitating independent research into nuclear science, the composition of its board raises serious doubts. Richard Florzone, a U of S vice president, was the chair of the Uranium Development Partnership in 2008-09, which strongly advocated value-added nuclear development in the province. Karen Chad, another U of S vice president, is also a board member of Enterprise Saskatchewan, a provincial government agency tasked with advancing the Uranium Development Partnership agenda. Jerome Konechny is the current CEO of Innovation Saskatchewan. Innovation Saskatchewan is the twin of Enterprise Saskatchewan and is, in fact, the government agency responsible for funding their nuclear innovation agenda. Bill Kupferschmidt is Vice President and General Manager of Research and Development at Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, the Federal Crown Corporation marketing CANDU reactor technology. Engin Usberg is Vice President, Cameco Uranium Technology and Innovation. Howard Wheater is a consultant to the state of Nevada concerning safety assessment for a proposed repository for a high-level radioactive waste dump at Yucca Mountain. And George Berezne, chair of the CCNI board, is the dean of the Faculty of Energy Systems and Nuclear Science at the University of Ontario Institute of Technology. Usually when announcements are made about future research and innovation arising from CCNI sponsorship, there is a great deal of fanfare about the prospects for nuclear medicine. It is definitely odd, then, that none of the CCNI directors has any obvious expertise in nuclear medicine. A carefully constituted board, cognizant of the broadest realm of social research concerns, would surely never have neglected the need to represent that balance of public interests. What was the U of S Board of Governors thinking when they approved these appointments? The key to it all seems to lie in the CCNI business framework, which clearly states the expectations of the provincial government in funding the Institute. Quote, to foster investment in nuclear research development and training in the nuclear sector as one part of its innovation agenda. For example, the province expects nuclear power to be considered in the range of energy options available for baseload generation capacity in the medium and long term after 2020, and that the CCNI will be able to serve as a source of expertise to inform decisions in this area. The province expects to refer third parties to the center as an informed point of contact to receive ideas for innovation in nuclear technologies and respond appropriately, unquote. The CCNI board was just appointed last December, and we do not know much of their deliberations to this point. Its first call for project proposals was issued just this summer, and those proposals are currently in the adjudication process. We are right to be concerned about the type of research the CCNI might be funding and where that funding is coming from. Corporate sponsorship is a big component of the success of project proposals. It seems to me that the University of Saskatchewan represents ground zero when it comes to the development and deployment of small nuclear reactors in Saskatchewan. We here in Saskatchewan have the responsibility to resist these efforts and to hold the People's University and our elected representatives in the provincial government accountable for the decisions being made largely behind closed doors. The implications for future generations are dire, and they cannot and should not be ignored. Thank you.
Research into the subject, trying to make the connections between what's happening at the U of S with the Canadian Center for Nuclear Innovation, the Board of Governors, and different corporations in the province as well as the government of Saskatchewan. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. And next, obviously going from that, when you think of nuclear, there's also the issue of nuclear waste, and the question arises when any nuclear reactor exists is where does that waste go and where does it get stored? And that is what Eileen Baer is going to talk to us about tonight. There are three communities in northern Saskatchewan being targeted as nuclear waste burial sites, and she's going to share some of her perspective and her experiences around that. So,
in the spring of 2011, elders and youth were gathered at Pine House Lake to discuss the important issues of suicide prevention. The facilitator wrote NUMO on a flip chart, then offered the Nuclear Waste Management Organization's plan for nuclear waste repository as an unparalleled economic opportunity that would address this problem of suicide. 12 elders got up and walked out. This was the first hint that most Northerners had about Saskatchewan being targeted for the nuclear industry's big mess. More than 2 million highly radioactive spent nuclear fuel cells. The administrations of Pine House, English River First Nation, and Creighton had applied to look into the site selection process of becoming Canada's deep geological waste repository without consulting their community members. The $16 to $24 billion carrot and promise of economic prosperity hooked them. The moment you hear the words high-level nuclear waste, what goes through your mind? Impending risk of monumental disaster, and how can I stop this from happening? The Committee for Future Generations was formed and immediately took action to find out what this entailed. The public forum was held in Beauvais in June 2011, where we viewed the information that NUMO provided on their website in the public kiosks. Throughout the region, NUMO declined the invitation to be present. Dr. Jim Harding presented the realities and risks involved, which were nowhere to be found in the NUMO material. 200 people from 12 communities across the northern said, "No way. Why should we take the responsibility of Ontario, Quebec, and New Brunswick?" Since then, our mandate has been to raise awareness throughout the province, the country, and internationally about the nuclear waste issue. We started a petition asking the government of Saskatchewan to legislate a ban on the storage and transportation of high-level nuclear waste in Saskatchewan. This past May, we presented more than 12,000 signatures representing 250 communities to the legislature. We are still accepting signatures requesting this ban. For 21 days in the summer of 2011, the Committee of Future Generations walked 850 kilometers from Pine House to Regina. The 7,000 Generation One Skull Walk united the people from north to south to share this common concern and know that through the air and the water that we are all connected. First Nations people teach that we must preserve the environment so that it will sustain the next 7 generations. We are trying to protect it for the next 7,000 generations, for that is how long it will take for the fusion products created by the nuclear power generators to decay. It is at this time which the living things will be considered safe. These fusion products are not naturally occurring, they are man-made. This NUMO proposal has changed our lives and the lives of the people in the northern region. Relationships amongst the people of Pine House are embroiled in conflict. More than half of the eligible voters have signed the petition against nuclear waste storage. The community is polarized between those concerned about the danger and those desperately wanting to tap the economic carrot. People live in a paranoid state, afraid they will lose a job or an opportunity in the community. 430 people of the English River First Nation out of an on-reserve population of 800 have already signed the NUMO against NUMO. That is the majority of adults living in the two communities. Most of the English River First Nation elders are clearly against hosting this nuclear waste dump in their lands. Their prophecies foretell of a terrible demon from under the ground that will cause the death of the people. There is no word for radiation or uranium in our languages. Yet our old people warn, the black rock is deadly. Leave it alone. Communities all over the North have been approached by the nuclear industry. They offer talk of economic benefit and employment. An elder who lives on and makes a living from the land, from Isla La Crosse, had said, "I looked around and saw all the gamblers and addicts nodding in agreement. It was only I who stood up and asked, what about the animals, the land, and the water?" Since Numa Winder proposals have come, the atmosphere in the communities have become very suspicious. No one trusts the intentions of Numa. When one of our committee members of the English River First Nation asked Pat Patton of Numa why, if the storage system is so fail-proof, why don't they just keep it in Ontario and save all the expenses of transporting it here? Her reply, "The people of Toronto don't feel safe." In essence, the 20,000 First Nation, Métis, and settler people of the northern Saskatchewan are being set up to take the risk and test the science for eastern Canada's consumers. As stated by NUMO President Ken Nash in an article by the Saskatoon Star Phoenix, "Over the past years, we have diligently done our research. We have learned a lot about the nuclear industry. We know that the Nuclear Waste Management Organization is a group of consultants working on behalf of Ontario Power Generation, Bruce Power Canco, Quebec Hydro, and New Brunswick Power, mandated by the Government of Canada to find a site for the long-term management of nuclear fuel. We know they have teams of people profiling our communities, looking for the weakest and most desperate members of our society to work through. They come in, spend their money under the guise of their corporate social responsibility fund, particularly on our youth and elders, put on displays of glossy, wordly information about their project, but never about the risk to our people. We know they label us fearmongers, yet they expect us to accept what they are afraid of. We know that the scientists, the engineers, and the physicians do not agree that the proposal will be an effective way to permanently seal this radioactive, highly dangerous problem forever. Nor can they guarantee us that there will be no risk to our health or to that of our future generations. We also know that Saskatchewan government and the uranium mining companies have for many years courted the United States about the possibilities of repatriating their nuclear waste. Thanks to NAFTA, that prospect looms omnipresent. We know that at the end of this proposal, there are plans for reprocessing the spent fuel to get at the plutonium. Plutonium is needed for nuclear weapons in the production of MOX fuel. Reprocessing uses a process of dissolving the spent fuel in acid to extract the plutonium. This will leave us with radioactive acid, and they do not describe this containment. We do know that where this is done in France, this waste leaks through its extremely thick concrete containers within 50 years. The new rule clearly states it will only look after the project for the next 60 to 100 years. This in our area of the world that is made up like a poor sponge full of water above and below the ground. We know our lands will become monitored and highly trained paramilitary security forces will lose our right to our cultural and traditional land uses and the right to be self-sustaining. The government of Saskatchewan and Canada are complicit at targeting the Aboriginal people and our lands to be the sacrifice for the nuclear industry's profit mongers. This is reinforced by their constant lack of sufficient funding, and most recently the cuts to the funding to the First Nation and Métis organizations. They are forcing our leaders to take the economic carrot offered by the nuclear industry. We have learned that SaskPower, although the people of Saskatchewan have clearly empathetically said no to the nuclear power in this province several times, are still pursuing the use of reactors for tar sands and now potash development. They also propose small reactors in remote northern communities, which would be better served with sustainable energy sources. If we have nuclear reactors, we will also have the nuclear waste. What do we do with it? Send it to Toronto? This summer, we put up a survival celebration camp for Sustainable Earth to give our people an opportunity to learn what we know and to share their knowledge and concerns. The elders, who are our scientists, wise in the ways of the earth, are very concerned for our future generations. They are seeing the beginning of a very bad time coming to destroy the world that has been taken for granted and abused. The Navajo tell us that the uranium is in the ground to control the weather. It is one of our earth's organs. The Dene prophet, Willow Hart, told us a time would come when we would no longer be safe living amongst the trees. Big winds will come and make life difficult. This time is now. The moose are moving south. The fish are sick and scarce. The waterfowl are very few, and the lakes and marshes are silent. Even the mosquitoes and sandflies are absent. The trees are turning a burnt brown between contamination from the tar sands and the radiation from the uranium mine tailings. Our people are dying. Yet there have been no health studies. Any anomalies are blamed on social economic conditions. In other words, if your employment opportunities are limited, you are poor, and more susceptible to poor health and higher cancer rates. Prior to the opening of the uranium mines in the north, we lived in even more rugged conditions and yet had much lower risks of developing cancer. We could very well be living with the last group of true elders, as the next group may not live long enough to gather all they must to earn and enjoy that status. We do not trust the nuclear industry. They have not demonstrated any respect for their life in the ecosystems they ravish. They have left behind messes. They have no idea how to clean up. The environmental assessments are a joke, and their impact studies clearly allow for contamination, which they deem as having no significant risk. We are dying. How many deaths will it take? The industries must be stopped. What happens to the land, the air, the water, the plants, the animals, and people in the north will also soon happen in the south. Radiation knows no borders. We are undertaking the 7,000 generation Northern Wake Up Tour as we speak, covering 10 to 12 communities in 2 weeks. We are gathering more support as people come to understand that what one community will do for money will ultimately put us all at risk. We are empowering the people to raise their voices to demand a return to sanity and not accept the radioactive legacy. And Martha, can you put your hand up, please? Martha has petitions if you already haven't signed.
So, thank you so much, Eileen, for sharing that. Sometimes, you know, when you hear, for instance, all the research and statistics and names and all of this stuff, it does take more of a personal side to really hit home. And so thank you so much for sharing what's going on in northern Saskatchewan and what it's doing to those three communities, separating people, really dividing the communities, and also threatening not just their way of life, but also their lives itself. So thank you. thank you so much for the work that the Committee for Future Generations is doing on that behalf, and I really appreciate you coming to share on our panel tonight. And so up next, we're going to switch gears a little bit and start talking a little bit about what's going on in Alberta with the expansion of the tar sands. And as you'll hear from Cam, it's really not so different in terms of what's happening to communities living downstream from the tar sands and the development that's happening there. So I'll let him explain it to you, because we'll do it best.
I want to start, before I start talking, by apologizing in advance, because I've been talking about the tar sands for a few years now, and I really feel like I kind of bum people out for a living. These days, just like, yeah, everything's pretty bad. So if it ever gets to that point in time, I'm sorry in advance. It's really interesting kind of where we're talking about this connection between the nuclear industry and the tar sands, because the relationship and the story between nukes and the tar sands actually started about 50 years ago. And this is back when the tar sands were still a pipe dream. There was still this thing that was, there was a little bit on the ground, there's a lot underground. And no one had quite figured out how to get it out yet. No one had figured out how to extract it from the sand and how to turn sort of this bituminous material into usable petroleum. And so one of the proposed ideas in order to how to make the tar sands into recoverable oil was to take a nuclear weapon, an actual nuclear bomb, and to bury it in northern Alberta, in the middle of the deposits up near Fort Mackay and Fort Chip. And to take this nuclear bomb, bury it, you know, 50, 60 meters underground, maybe 100, and blow it up. And the logic being that it would liquefy everything and then separate out upon sort of the settling of the explosion, I guess, and then the sand and the oil would all be separated and you could put regular oil rigs on it and just suck it up. I mean, I would say thankfully they didn't do that, but what they're doing right now these days isn't much better. At least then, you know, it would have been a quick thing instead of the slow industrial genocide that we have today. And so, to kind of talk about the tar sands, I'm going to kind of try and start at one point and take it sort of one step smaller as we go. So, I'm going to try and run through the kind of basic part really quickly, because, you know, I think a lot of people have probably heard of this stuff before. So the tar sands, for anyone who doesn't know, are a massive deposit of oil-rich bitumen in northern Alberta, in the northeast of the province. It's an area that roughly covers the size of the state of Florida, and that's including in situ and surface mine. And so in situ is a terminology used to refer to tar sands deposits that are underground, and then the rest is surface mine. And there is much more underground than there is surface mine. But most of what you've seen, if you've seen photos of it, it's surface mining. It's this gigantic Mordor-esque sort of toxic wasteland where it has these things that look like Tonka trucks that, you know, are from those things from the movie Avatar. Generally looks like kind of the end of the world up there. And so to understand the tar sands and actually the connection to why, you know, they would even consider developing nuclear power to power this thing is, again, to kind of have to go back 50 years. And 50 years, it's sort of in 1956, 1957, there was a scientist who started talking about the idea of peak oil. And this is the idea that we were going to run out, and they had predicted in about the 70s, we're going to run out of cheap, accessible, recoverable oil. And we have. We are, as a society, out of cheap energy. We are out of cheap oil, we are out of natural gas, and we are out of coal. We have been out of it for a long time, which is why today we are the industries of traditional ways of getting out sort of fossil fuels from the ground are declining or gone. So that's why we have things like the tar sands, which before today, before we ran out of cheap energy, was economically infeasible. That's why in the southern United States we have something called mountaintop coal removal to get a large amount of the coal in the U.S., which involves blowing up mountains to get a coal seams inside of them. That's why we have fracking, which involves pumping 600 chemicals into the ground with a bunch of sand into aquifers in order to break up shale in order to get it natural gas, because we've used everything we already had. So the tar sands kind of represent this idea of what we consider extreme extraction. And the further we go down this path, the more we're using dangerous and deadly technologies. And so in that sense, and don't use the word deadly lightly, because the tar sands represent this in a number of ways. And I think the most prevalent, or one of the most important, that it doesn't get sort of put to the forefront enough, is that within the tar sands and downstream from the tar sands are communities of people who have lived off the land there for generations. And there's two primary ones sort of, I guess, right in the hot zone, for lack of a better term. And one is Fort MacKay. And Fort MacKay is about 40 kilometers north of Fort McMurray, which is sort of the largest city up there. And it's literally in the middle of mines and upgraders. 2 years ago, it was discovered that there was a three-sided tailings pond. So they just decided to build a lake and not bound it on one side and fill it with toxic sludge. And tailings ponds are where they put all the water that you require to turn bitumen, which is this kind of gummy, black, almost chewing gum-esque consistency, into usable oil. And it requires up to five barrels of water. It's 2 to 5 because they've gotten a bit better at it. But they still create a large amount of toxic sludge to actually produce tar sands bitumen, to turn tar sands bitumen into usable oil. And a fun fact, Canada is home to the second largest dam in the world. It's holding back a toxic lake from flowing into the Athabasca River in northern Alberta. If you were only to look at dams holding back toxic lakes, we are number one. We have the largest dam holding back a toxic lake anywhere in the world. It's massive. You can see it from space. And so what this means is that you have all of this air pollution and water pollution directly impacting the communities up there. So you have fish that people have lived on for generations, which now are no longer edible because they're coming out of the water with tumors. You have water that's no longer drinkable. And we're talking about the other community that's a bit further upstream, the community of Fort Chipewyan. It's a flying community. It's only accessible by boat and plane in the summer and by ice road and plane in the winter. So if you take away fresh water, local food, the plants and animals that people have depended upon, you're taking away not only a traditional way of life, but also the fact that when you talk about northern communities anywhere, it's extremely expensive to get food into these places, to get clean water into these places. And so it really is representing sort of the destruction of a people's way of life. And then to take it sort of that one step further downstream, sort of into the bigger sense of why we should all be really, if you're not already concerned about it because it's killing people, like I said, bumming people out for a living. To take it sort of the next step further, I want to sort of give you two numbers to understand this. And so the first one is 565. And 565 is the number of gigatons of carbon dioxide we can safely put into the atmosphere and have a well-agreed-upon scientific chance of keeping warming below 2 degrees Celsius. Now, 2 degrees Celsius is already too much, in my opinion, because that already is going to displace millions of people. It is already going to drown island states. But that's about the best we can kind of aim for right now. The other number is 2,765. That is the number of gigatons of carbon dioxide currently held in the fossil fuel industry, so oil, gas, and coals, proven reserves. So that's what they want to put into the atmosphere. So the numbers don't work. We have basically an industry that wants to go 5 times over the maximum limit of what they can put into something. So basically, like, I've given you a cup, or I have a cup, and you want to dump a pitcher into it. It's like, no, it's not going to work, but you're still just going to keep dumping the pitcher into it. So within this sort of whole framework is this thing called the tar sands, and there's a lot of fight. There's, I think, right now, a national and sort of international fight over what's this world going to look like 3, 5, 10 years down the road. And are we going to build a society which is based upon collectively, creating a just and sustainable future together and building something that's better for our generation and those that are next? Or are we going to burn every last drop of fossil fuels so that some of the richest corporations on the planet can continue to get richer? And so when we talk about the tar sands, a lot of the time there's been a lot saying, oh, it's not really that bad, it's not that much. Right now, the amount of economically developable tar sands currently slated for development represent the same amount of carbon dioxide as burning every ounce of proven coal reserves in Canada. Burning all of the currently economically accessible tar sands in Canada represents the amount of fossil fuels burned to date, that have, since we've historically kept records of this, in Canada or India. Burning the amount that will become economical, as it's slated to see in the next 20 years, represents burning all of the natural gas which has ever been burned on the planet to date. And then there's another number beyond that, which is that burning everything that's not economic today, not going to be economic in 20 years, and no one thinks is going to be economic in, you know, beyond that. That being said, no one thought that tar sands would ever be economic. And that just basically represents game over. So we're talking about an industry which has the potential, and it's been referred to as this, as a carbon bomb. It has the potential alone to cause massive climatic forcing. And I mean, we've seen it this summer. You know, we're coming out of the hottest summer on record. And this is also this September, and we'll build it up October, the 330th month in a row, which has been hotter than the month that has broken temperature records. We came out of a summer which saw the largest retreat in Arctic ice ever seen, and saw the Greenland ice sheet, 97% of it was melting at one point in time this summer. Normally 40% of it melts in the summer. And so that kind of, what we're seeing with these massive shifts, where we're talking about extreme weather patterns, these unprecedented and unpredictable increases in sea ice melt, this is what people were warning about 20 years ago when they said feedback loops, when they said that we will get to a point where we won't know what's going to happen. Because what we're seeing is we're seeing hundreds of years worth of climatic shifts happening in decades or happening in years. And so, to go back to something I said before, I think this is gives kind of help build it into what Megan's going to talk about, is when I said that what we're doing right now is burning every last ounce, sort of our future, to give the richest corporations in the world more money, I'm not exaggerating. In 2011, the five largest oil companies on Earth made $140 billion. The quarter before that, and they've built on this since then, ExxonMobil made more money than has ever been made in the history of money. Last year, to sort of continue putting this perspective, last year, Shell, just in Canada alone, got a $32 million tax refund from our government. So when we talk about this and talk about, A, how do we, needing to change this and needing to sort of move to a more just and sustainable future, what we're talking about in a lot of ways is we're talking about taking on the richest industries in the world, and right now, the most powerful forces on our planet. And I don't say that lightly or mean to say it hyperbolically. I legitimately believe this. And we've seen the impacts that they can have. You're talking about forces that are backed up by, you know, the Koch brothers in the United States. We're talking about forces in Canada, which I don't think it's a stretch to say, that have bought our federal government and sold our environmental regulations. And so when we're talking about this, we're talking about kind of connecting this, and I think, like, I consider, you know, this drive to, you know, nuclear power, especially with powering the tar sands, is part of this idea of extreme extraction, and that we're scraping the bottom of the barrel for energy. And we're scraping the bottom of the barrel because that's where there's billions of dollars to be made. There is no $1 billion to be made in renewable energy. The reason why we will never see Shell, Exxon, Enbridge, any of these companies start putting up wind turbines or start actually meaningfully investing in renewable energy is because it will never fit in their bottom line. And they will never buy or sell or create the noose to hang themselves. I'm going to steal a story or sort of a metaphor from a friend of mine who's sitting in a prison cell in Utah right now for disrupting a land sale auction a couple years ago. And this guy named Tim DeChristopher, and he said once, he was talking to him once, and he was sort of explaining why, we were having this conversation about why the current corporate model, or why we have to unseat the fossil fuel industrial complex, for lack of a better term, is because when you think about the way we make energy today, and it's the exact same as when we're talking about the way that nuclear power is sold, it fits into the same model. And as we make energy in the hinterlands from our societies, or from our major cities, or where these large economic sort of bases are, where the large voting bases are, you'll never see a coal-fired power plant or a nuclear storage facility in downtown Toronto. It's never going to happen. So we build them in these mass scales in the hinterlands. We build them in the northern Alberta, where the tar sands are. We build massive hydroelectric dams in northern Quebec, so on and so on and so forth. And because think about your house or your apartment. Think about the way that we produce most of our electricity in Canada is coal. And so if I were to think about powering my house alone using my own sort of using energy that I could create on my house or sort of at a small scale, it's ridiculous for me to think that I could go out and buy a small coal-fired power plant and go and install it on the side of my apartment and then go into the middle of town and like mine some coal, bring it home, and, like fill it up and burn it and be like, cool, I'm making my own energy. That's ridiculous. That'll never happen. I'll never be able to build a little natural gas plant on the side of my house. But I can contemplate and I can think about how I could use a combination of renewable energies, wind, solar, geothermal, passive heating. I can think about how all of these things could work together. And I can actually imagine feasibly how you could power my house or how you could power my block using these energies. And that's why these sort of we need to take down and create a drastic shift away from the current economic model and the current energy production model, because what renewable energy really represents, it represents a democratization of the largest force of political and economic power in our country and I consider around the world. And that's why it's such a threat. That's why oil companies are spending billions of dollars funding climate change denial science. That's why they're funding political parties, which they know will allow them to continue as business as usual. Because business as usual will destroy our planet. Renewable energy and the sort of shifts we need to make to change it require not just changing the window dressing. It requires deep shifts and requires completely kind of flipping our economic system on its head. I think that's a good transition to let you take over.
Okay. Thanks a lot for that, Cam. So I hope as we kind of continue down the panel that you're starting to be able to make some of these own links in your head as to, okay, nuclear, and then what is nuclear waste burial doing to communities, and what does this have to do with the tar sands? Why is this bad if we have nuclear power powering the tar sands? And starting to get these things going in your head. And Megan is going to finish off the panel tonight with a bit of a discussion about why it's important for us as youth to get really engaged in these issues and what kind of things we need to see in the future. And then following that, we'll have a question and answer period.
Thank you. I don't know if I can top what Cam was saying, but maybe I won't thumb you guys out just as much as he did. We'll see. So I'm super excited about everybody that came out tonight. I think it's really important that we are engaging the youth, which is a lot of you guys, but I also think it's really important that we have people from other generations, because it's a fight we all have to fight together, regardless of where we're from, where we're going to go, anything like that. So I think this is really awesome. So I think that everything is connected to climate change. If you really think about it, everything, you can find a link. So it's important to break these big ideas down into concepts that are local, that we can feel actually impact us. And that's why we basically brought you guys here today to discuss the tar sands and nuclear development. The tar sands require an astronomical amount of energy, almost half of what it will produce at the point of consumption. And nuclear power enables the tar sands. And thus, it enables the destruction of ecosystem health, human health, and is setting our generation and future generations
up for failure as we rely on a resource that is finite and has already hit its peak. And so now that we've learned about the nuclear and tar sands agenda, and we've learned a little bit about how they're connected, and maybe, you know, feel a little bit bummed out about it, we have to think about how it affects our future. And as we move towards a carbon-constrained world, it is the youth that will fully experience the consequences of today's actions. But I want to tell you guys that it's probably not too late, and that's why we're here to talk about it. We, the people of the youth of today, we're pretty malleable. Maybe we're still in university, or maybe we're just trying to figure out what we're going to do with our lives. We probably don't have careers yet, and maybe we don't have daily habits. Maybe every single day we do something different. And that means that we can actually choose to live lifestyles that are sustainable and make decisions that will allow things to shift in our society. And I think that everything, our whole society, can shift in one generation if we let it. And we can make the changes happen that we want to see happen. And I think it's important for us to remember that if we don't care about this stuff, we can't expect anybody else to care. Young people deserve to be regarded as actively engaged citizens, and we also deserve to be an integral part of the decision-making process that our current leaders are making. And often, the youth are disregarded in important decision-making processes, and so it's important for us to educate ourselves and take back our own power. When we empower ourselves, we empower our governments, because we will then be able to build the country that we want to live in. The number of young people around the world has never been higher. More than half of the world population is made up of people under the age of 30. And I think that this stat has really struck a chord with me, especially last year when I attended the United Nations climate change negotiations. And this was right after our world population had hit 7 billion. So we need to put this into perspective. Almost 4 billion people are children, teenagers, and young adults. And out of that 4 billion, over 1 billion of those people are between the ages of 15 and 24. So they're the educators, the teachers, the parents of the next generation. And so we really need to tap into that and get these people engaged and get ourselves engaged. So I mentioned earlier a little bit about the United Nations Climate Change Conference and how I was there. And I think, well, first I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So each year these negotiations bring leaders from around the world into one place and basically discuss the reduction of greenhouse gases. And each year at the same time, hundreds of youth follow these leaders to these places and try and become actively involved in the decision-making process and the negotiations that occur there. It's actually really challenging because the youth are disregarded and often not considered an important part of any of it. And that's just the reality of it at this point. I think there was one day last year in South Africa, this is where the United Nations conference was held, that I met with the people that went there from the Canadian government. And basically I asked them how they value youth participation within international policy decision making. And they told me a big long thing about how they used to bring youth from Canada to kind of learn about what they do as the government delegation and become a little bit more involved in the process. And they said they don't do that anymore. They don't bring youth within their delegation. And that makes me think, do they actually care about the youth? Do they actually care about our generation? And I wonder why. And I think we should all wonder why. We should always ask why. And so instead of perpetuating tokenism, which occurs when youth appear to have a voice, but it really have little or no choice in how they participate, so instead of that, there needs to be a strong sense of intergenerational collaboration and meaningful youth participation in all policy decision-making. And with the current state of affairs comes hope, because disproportionate participation and its impacts on youth constituents around the world and even at home here in Saskatchewan creates an opportunity for youth mobilization and civic participation. Young people are concerned, thoughtful citizens who are capable of participating in and changing the society of which we are a part. And we should, like I've said before, have an important role in addressing and affecting the world in which we live. We also have advantages. We don't want to forget this. We are energetic, we are enthusiastic, we are imaginative, and we can use those skills to become effective communicators and engage in local actions. And as we've heard from others who spoke tonight, the decisions made by our leaders, our current leaders, are in many cases not reflective of the most vulnerable communities. Age equality is necessary for strong, balanced governance and the ability for our current leaders to leave a positive legacy for future generations. And I think we are currently experiencing really strange dynamics. In 20 years, young people will have the opportunity to make completely uninhibited decisions, or at least we should have that opportunity. But instead, we are and will be forced to live with the consequences of today's poor decisions. And if we continue to rely on dirty energy, future generations don't stand a chance. In 20 years, we will be able to make informed decisions. But instead, today, we aren't given that opportunity. And decisions are being made for us and are often uninformed or only provide short-term economic gain. And I think that Saskatchewan and our country as a whole has the opportunity to become a world leader in renewable energy and sustainable practices. And it starts with one voice, and another, and it progresses until we are a strong, completely empowered force to be reckoned with. And I think that that'll make our current leaders, they won't have the opportunity but listen to us. They'll have to listen. They won't really have a choice. So if we can create critical mass, if we can come together as a generation, involve those older and younger than us, we will become a powerful force for positive change. But I think we need to realize how serious the issue is. There's no room for negotiation when it's our future that's at stake. If we continue to rely on our leaders to make decisions, our planet will become completely unlivable. But I think that our generation is capable of changing the world. So we just need to remember that. So I don't know if we should talk about power shift a little bit.
Yeah, I can touch on power shift a bit. So thanks a lot, Megan. So myself, Megan, and Cam are some of the organizers for Power Shift 2012, which, like I mentioned earlier, is a four-day gathering happening in Ottawa in October of this year. And it will bring together youth from all across the country with the common goal of what Megan was talking about, to educate ourselves, develop the skills that we need to start taking back our power and start being able to, force ourselves on the decision makers so that we don't have to live with the consequences of some of these very poor decisions that are happening right now in Saskatchewan, in Canada, and, you know, in countries all around the world. So if anybody has questions about that, you can feel free to come talk to any one of us after the fact. But right now I'll open up the floor to anybody who might have a question for any one of our presenters. And we'll maybe leave about 20 minutes for that. And then there's some juice and cookies. And also, if you have the means, we would really appreciate a donation. Like I said, everybody on this panel is a volunteer and here out of their own time. And Cam came from out of province as well, so it would be really appreciated. But I'll open it up to questions. And like I said earlier, just try to keep it respectful.
And too, if you guys, like as youth or really anybody that's here, if you guys have stories or anything that has to do with the barriers or obstacles that you've encountered within the climate movement or just in whatever way, it'd be really great to hear about it.
Okay. in Yellowknife, Betchikol, like in the Northwest Territories, and I learned a lot about what's going on up there in the Mackenzie River and how they're trying to build the dam and how the, like, the caribou are moving away from the pass, so people who live off the land aren't really able to, and they're full of, like, remote communities. A high population of the Northwest Territories in the rural is, like, around 15 years old. So there's not a lot of people, there's not a lot of, I guess, there's a huge gap in the information that's being shared between the adults and the young people. And there's, these oil companies are, and the diamond mines are going to these schools and, like, telling these young people that they can make more than their teacher if when they're in grade 10, if they get past grade 10, and then they can come work with the oil companies and the diamond mines. And the Mackenzie River is one of the only rivers in the world that runs up north into the Beaufort Sea. And there's a young lady up there who is, like, really trying to mobilize the community but is being, like, kind of shushed by a lot of decision makers. And I know that the federal government is trying to, or the Crown is trying to settle, like, all the land claims, and there's only two that needs to be settled right now. And then they're going through a process called devolution, where their budget is going to be taken care of by the government of Northwest Territories, and it costs, like, $85 million a year. That's how much, like, it costs to run all their, you know, government stuff. And they're only being proposed, they're only getting $65 million after the devolution process goes through. So that means their communities are going to be more pressured to take on, just like the same thing that's going on in Saskatchewan. I thought it was worse in Northwest Territories. So it's really, I feel really grateful to be here and hearing everything that's going on here, and it's scaring the shit out of me. But I think, like, it's making me realize that this whole process is a lot bigger, and it is everybody's, like, it is a intergenerational thing, right? It's not just the youth, but we do need to wake up, and you guys are really saying it in a language that I understand and that I'm going to be able to share with other people. But I'm really, like, wondering if you guys know anything about devolution, or if you're able to explain it. Have you heard of it? No, not really.
Well, I mean, a lot of just that process and what's going on around that area is the residual hangover, for lack of a better term, of the Mackenzie Gas Project, which was 20 to 30 years ago. What the government of Canada was saying was going to, you know, be our greatest energy project. And 30 years ago, it was rejected and resisted by almost all the communities along the route, and they basically spent a 20 to 30 year, like, timeline through a serious process of undermining the traditional governance structures, undermining community resistance, and using all of the sort of dirty tricks of the Indian Act to go through that. That's sort of the only actual, like, kind of framework I know it through is through the Mackenzie Gas Project stuff, and that's kind of where all the settlements are trying to go through. And that's only at the front of my mind because the premier of the NWT had possibly the stupidest idea I've ever heard 2 weeks ago, where he wanted to ship tar sands oil up the Mackenzie Gas Pipeline because the gas pipeline isn't going to run anymore. But yeah, it's basically, it's similar to, I mean, I worked with a community in northern Quebec called Barrier Lake for a lot of years that was under similar processes, which is basically that, you know, there's a long history of the government of Canada using specifically the Indian Acts, but also a lot of other sort of tools in order to undermine community resistance, especially when there's a very strong pushback against resource development projects. That's, you know, sort of, there's a lot of different sort of tools within that arsenal, but it basically is in order to be able to push these sort of projects forward and be able to kind of extract resources because of the fact, you know, and the concept, or I guess in an academic parlance of environmental racism, the idea that there are people or that there's people that live in certain areas which are disproportionately affected by extractive industries and by the, you know, extraction of natural resources, and that's because of and through history of colonialism. That's, I guess, the best explanation I've got.
Yeah, I can't really help but see the relationship between the Indian Act and what you guys are talking about today. That's kind of what's going through my mind. I'm going to study that relationship. But that alone is absolutely appalling. And, yeah, it's like, it's so dirty. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I asked have a specific question for Amy, but I also have a comment. Megan, the loss of the youth portion of the feds when they go to UN meetings occurred at the same time that they decided to stop the use of funds, citizens groups, a few citizens groups, and I'm not sure how you apply to do that, but they stopped funding NGOs as well. And partly, I'm quite convinced, and call me paranoid, but that it is to stop dissent. And the youth was particularly embarrassing because they were asked a lot of questions. Any of the young people who went in the past were very good at looking at the nuggets and getting past the BS. Mm-hmm. And our Canadian government has become less and less likely to want anybody asking questions like that. And Eileen, you commented, you said something, pardon me if I'm sort of holding here, but you said the name, this, I thought this is so funny, this person from Nemo said that the people of Toronto are afraid of the waste?
Right.
Who was that? Who was the Nemo person named? You named that person.
Pat Patton.
Well, that's just too good a story for us to be telling a lot of, eh? Isn't that fantastic? And then for everybody, I guess I have a question because you're all working on these kinds of things and we're in the audience listening to you. What particular thing or what particular group of people or who would you like any one of us to try and target to take these messages further? To describe our concerns about the use of, I'll make it specific, the use of nuclear power to bring up lousy energy to literally kill our planet. You know, outdo the 565 or 656? 565. I think I wrote 656. Oh, no, I got 565, number of kilotons of carbon dioxide. So if you were going to say, maybe pick two or three people that each one of us could try and pick on, we should go home and do tonight, or tomorrow, or who we should talk to. How can we move it? How can we move it?
Well, I guess I think, from my perspective, I think obviously the two big groups are the big polluters and our elected officials. And I know that when we try to contact them, it doesn't feel like they're listening. And maybe they're not. But if enough of us try and contact them, I really think that they can't help but hear us. They may not like what we're saying, but at least we're not just being, you know, our letters or our phone calls aren't just being completely dismissed. I think, from my perspective, I guess I just think that contacting our government is much more is what we can do right now. And I think, you know, you can do that in a variety of ways, depending on how comfortable you are with the issues. You can write letters. You can call. Probably, if we're talking specifically nuclear and tar sands, we'd want to contact people that are closer to home, so our provincial governments, or maybe even, you know, if you know someone within your municipal government or from somewhere else, that's even a good place to start. And I think it's also really important for you, if you're writing a letter specifically to somebody, you want to CC basically everybody you can so that everybody knows that you're sending this letter out. You can call people, but I think, you know, depending on what we want to do, if you're part of a youth group or if you want to start something, it's important for us to actually engage in actions and make ourselves seen and not just heard. And not just read. And so that's something we can do too. And there's lots of groups around, even Saskatoon, that put together these actions and so that you can get involved, or if you have fresh new ideas, which I'm sure many of you do, that's always a place to start as well.
Yeah, I guess I'll go with two as well, because they're kind of for different groups. One of them is that, and this is also somewhat tied to a shameless plug on behalf of the CYCC, but I have to do that every now and then. But one of them is that in this country, more so than in a lot of the world, dirty energy and extractive industries are getting a free ride on our campuses. They're all over, from tar sands companies, mining companies, and here, nuclear energy companies. They're basically investing in universities, not only sort of to get cheap research, but also to normalize their existence. Because if you go to school in the Syncrude Energy Lecture Hall, and that which exists at the University of Alberta, I was at a tar sands conference in it, which was awesome. But you come out, and that's a part of just normal existence. It normalizes it. So I think we need to kind of take a lesson from, especially like students, need to take a lesson from the South African anti-apartheid movement and turn these campuses into a battleground around this. And I think that ties into this idea and sort of what we're starting to actually see in the fight against the tar sands. We're starting to see, and this, to use the industry's term, they're getting landlocked in bitumen. And that's their term that they're using because all of their pipelines keep getting blocked. Because it slowly started, a lot of it started outside of Canada, started in the UK and the US, where people started to learn about the tar sands and be like, this is a huge problem. And so you started to see policies come forward, groups come up about divestment, groups stopping pipelines, like in the Keystone XL last year, and starting to close in. And we started to see this noose almost closing in on the tar sands. And so if that's happened, you know, these companies at Enbridge, Encana, Suncor, Syncrude, Shell, all of them, if they become pariahs on campuses, well, they're becoming pariahs in other countries, in other cities, well, we're banning the tar sands, you know, from use in truck fleets at companies, or entire cities are banning its import, or we're blocking all these pipelines, it's just going to start closing in. And we're already seeing that. I think the momentum's already going. It started with this little snowball, and it's getting bigger and bigger. And so I think that there's this massive potential on campus around tar sands, but around all sorts of dirty energy, to go after these corporations and make them unwelcome, turn it into a big issue. And there's a lot for students. You know, it's pretty easy to get stories and op-eds and school papers to turn these things into blanket schools and, you know, posters. Also, you can get away with a lot more without getting arrested on campus than you can outside of it. And outside of it, going after, I think that, like, there's a certain point of needing to sort of, you know, really turn these corporations into pariahs, or turn politicians who put the interests of polluting corporations ahead of the interests of people into, you know, the toxic substances that they represent, and make them so that they will never, ever stand for office again, or make it so that they will, that it really costs them. And I think it's kind of build off one thing that Megan said. I think our default is to go back to, like, who do we write a letter to, or who do we talk to? And I think there is this need to kind of to step it up. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. I mean, there's things going on. Like, for example, there's going to be a massive civil disobedience action in Victoria in late October. But there's also a lot of things you can do that aren't sort of quite as far away, or this massive thing. And one of my personal favorites is to pull pranks on politicians and corporations and governments, because it's a lot of fun. In, for example, about basically a year and a week ago, Karen and I were part of a group that re-released a 15-year-old Government of Canada education policy through a fake Environment Canada website, forcing them to deny they had ever put it out, and then they realized they had put it out 15 years ago, and they actually used to care about climate change. there's a lot of these sorts of things you can do. And so I think that, like, there's a lot that can be done with, you know, using... It doesn't always have to be, like, just, you know, standing and blocking. That's really necessary and useful at times. But I think in terms of this, you know, like, force the invisible to become the visible by, like, using humor, by using these sort of other things, and using the other avenues through, you know, social media or online pranks and things like that. Because things that I've done through that have gotten, you know, massive amounts of attention shone on issues. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, potential doing that sort of thing.
Can I just follow up with you, Cam, on that? You were talking about the massive action that's happening in Victoria.
at the end of October. That's Save Our Coast, and that's a lot of Bill McKibben, who circled the White House with 12,000 people last September. That is going all across Canada, and we've had a few quick discussions on it here in Saskatoon right now, and probably October 21st we're hoping to have a massive demonstration here in Saskatoon. So please leave, can we leave your email addresses or your phone numbers, email addresses, just with the Hughes people, because so that we can get hold of you and let you know what's going on. We're going to have something really big happening here. We can't sit back any longer and let only the oil companies' voices be heard. Our politicians have to hear from us, and in mass. So, thanks.
I'd just like to see if Eileen or Darcy, if either of you have any one person or any group of people in mind to answer that last question around who you think or who your group thinks should be targeted when people are trying to reach out and say that this is not acceptable anymore. Yeah, the government of Saskatchewan. Darcy?
Well, politicians are always susceptible, of course, and I think that's why things have transpired as far as the nuclear industry in Saskatchewan, that there was a massive outcry against the Uranium Development Partnership 3 years ago, and it did change the government's course. But of course, being sneaky, they routed that effort then through the university to give it this legitimacy that universities always claim. Whether it's deserved or not, one begins to wonder. But I think people, and I think it's a very good idea that students on campus need to become more active, and I think there are all sorts of student groups that could do that. I think alliances are really important, and it's important for those student groups on campus to also have alliances off campus. As we talk about this intergenerational, and there's also the Occupy movement. There are huge numbers of youth that aren't represented on university campuses and need to be involved in this whole process. One of the things that I think also needs to be done is that we have to think locally. We think we're a backwater in Saskatchewan, but in fact, when it comes to the nuclear industry, this is where it's happening. These are where the decisions are being made. We can make the difference right here. The university will take note. The university administration will take note of our concerns and our protests if we are effective in channeling those to the right people. And the Board of Governors is one way to address those issues, but also, and I think the faculty and staff of campus are actually the most vulnerable group. They're the ones that are taking the biggest risk by voicing opposition to the administration, because there are repercussions for them to do that. Students will possibly have some repercussions too, but not nearly to the same extent. And I think university alumni also have to take the responsibility to get involved. And I think this group called Usward, University Senators in Saskatchewan, working to revive democracy, is an important group. They have now only a quarter of the university senate is elected. But about half of those university senators over the last 3 years have now kind of aligned themselves with the Usward agenda, which is to challenge, first of all, this nuclear agenda, but also all sorts of other kind of corporate operational modus operandi type of things that are going on. So they are challenging the university administration. So I think if the students and alumni in particular, but also faculty and staff, if they can create these alliances and show solidarity, that will make a difference in what is happening here at the university.
Thank you. Thanks. I think maybe time for one more question. Somebody has something they want to ask. Okay.
Then I have one other thing.
Okay.
I forgot. I had something I was going to tell Pam, and that was, because I think you said 20-some years ago we were warned about the energy. 36 years ago,
The article appeared in Ramparts Magazine out of San Francisco, I think it was Sunday, and it said, it's happening, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Had to add the numbers.
I've got one, I guess, small comment. When I work with youth, I'm a grade 8 teacher, and they're pretty motivated and inspired sometimes. And they're definitely, like, we want them to have their own opinions. And if there was something I could implant in them, it would be to demand that some of the sort of 60-plus people get active because they've got resources and they've got time. And I don't know how to tap what that looks like to tap into that generation, but I think that would be a great place to go, because I think of sometimes youth that have a lot of ideas and also energy also earn minimum wage, right? Mm-hmm. So there could be some really great partnerships with some useful connections.
And then just connecting to that, sorry, I'm part of a group that's trying to start a public interest research group on campus here in Saskatoon, and then that would provide those resources. It's basically a student-funded resource center to go out into the community and do those things that are centered around social and environmental justice. So if any students here are interested in being a part of that, just come talk to me, and I'd be glad to share information.
Thank you so much again, everybody, for coming out. And like I said, feel free to mingle for a while and have a coffee and some juice and ask us any other questions that you may have after. But let's thank all the panelists again for being here.